Hello and welcome to the EOISS podcast, a conversation on foreign policy what-if scenarios. My name is Florence Gaub and I'm the host of the show. And with me today is Alice Eckmann, our expert on China. Welcome, Alice.
Thanks, Florence.
So you know that in this series, we're going to talk about expectations gone wrong. We're having a conversation about Russia. And today we're having a conversation with you on China, what we got wrong on China. Now, I have here two quite juicy examples from the past, how we got China wrong. One is from 1995, an article that appeared in Foreign Policy called The Coming Chinese Collapse, which declared that China will crumble in the next 10 to 15 years, economically speaking and so forth. And then 5 years later, we have, of course, the famous speech by Bill Clinton saying that China is importing not only the products, but also the values of democracy, i.e., sous-entendu, it will become a democracy. Now, of course, these things have not happened. And I know that you have other examples on what we got wrong on China. What are they?
Of course, Florence, I have so many examples. When you ask me the question, I have a long list, but just to identify four. First of all, we clearly underestimated China's ability to integrate into the international system, into international organization, including UN agencies. I can develop much more, but today, you know, China is heading four of the 15 UN specialized agencies. And apart from these agencies, you also have Interpol, which China headed at some point. I won't go into detail, but there is a lot of examples showing that China managed to integrate into the international system.
Can I just ask, when you say integrate, we didn't think it was going to play an active role in it and use it for its diplomatic power purposes?
No, we didn't think, because if we remember well, I know under Deng Xiaoping, so first China integrated international organization, access to international organization rather late, you know, because there was a competition between the PRC, People's Republic of China, and the ROC/Taiwan. So China access to the UN in 1971, but it was a step-by-step integration, and China really participated, so most of the time observed how it worked, but did not really play an active role. And Deng Xiaoping himself at the time said, China actually does not have the means to promote, to support a very active diplomacy, because China was so poor at the time. The day after the Cultural Revolution, China really had to focus on domestic economic development and could not afford a very ambitious foreign policy. But time has gone, and China now is the second largest economy in the world, and this was hard to anticipate. So a lot of our misperception is due to our inability to anticipate that China would become such an economic power. And with economic power also come diplomatic ambition, also comes also experience in integration in the practice of diplomacy in key international organization, and also come a key leader, Xi Jinping, in 2012, with very ambitious foreign policy perspective, also domestic policy, but foreign policy perspective. So you have a combination of a new economic status with the arrival of a very ambitious president, and that was hard to anticipate. So that's why we misunderstimated, I would say, China's efficiency to integrate into international organization, but also we underestimated China's ability to innovate. And there is a case of 5G, but also facial recognition.
Yeah, we thought China was going to be just copying everybody for
a long
time.
Yeah, we heard that still 5 years ago, we heard that very commonly. China would never be able to innovate given its political system. Given it's very top-down, there is really no space for free and indigenous research. So in this situation, we should not consider that China will be able to innovate anytime soon. But it's actually revealed to be wrong. This hypothesis is clearly wrong today. Of course, there is some nuance. Control of the research is real, especially in social science. In some areas, there is no possibility to conduct research, but in some others, the government is investing massively for China to become a leading tech champion. So I mentioned the case of telecommunication network, 5G and next generation, but also facial recognition, but also sensors that are used in smart cities. Also, China is investing massively in not only in the use of technology in an urban environment, but in the application, for example, smartphone app, etc., etc. So China is still very much dependent on foreign technologies, especially semiconductors and also operating system. But overall, there is innovation capabilities that we underestimated 5, 10 years, even more 15 years ago.
I think we also, obviously, the Bill Clinton quote shows this. We underestimated the resilience of the Communist Party,
yeah.
Or rather perhaps Xi Jinping's power to control it or coercion over it?
Yeah, that was actually the third example I had in mind. And totally, we completely underestimated party's resilience for several reasons. Also because it goes against our assumption. You know, when Bill Clinton says naturally China would democratize, and in substance, a lot of economists also said that with economic opening up, political liberalization will unfold step by step. You cannot really develop economically if you don't have an open governance system, a more open governance system. That's a classic assumption. First of all, China has never been really open economically. So one misperception led to another one. You understand? So we consider that from Deng Xiaoping onward, China really promoted an era of reform and opening up. That was the official label, but in concrete terms, state-owned enterprises remain very central to China's economic growth. Party sales are omnipresent. They are present everywhere in all state-owned enterprises. But also today, if I check it, well, in 2019 figures, the party sales are present in more than 1.5 million private companies. It's still actually a planned economy. I assume to say that, but you have a planning body called National Development and Reform Commission that is very powerful. You have five-year plan. You know, the next one is coming very shortly. You have, I mean, a lot of planning documents issued by the central government. It's a very special economic system that has partly liberalized, but not fully, not to the point that we anticipated in 1995, for instance. So this partial liberalization also put into question the assumption that political openness is necessary for economic growth, because China is now the second largest economy in the world. China is full of contradiction. I mentioned it's planned economy, but it's partly opened. So managing this assumption, this nuance, even from a theoretical point of view, is very difficult and put into question also the rationale behind, I mean, the economic justification of democratic development, saying that democracy is not just good for the sake of democracy, for freedom of speech, expression, etc., but it's also good for economic development. China seems to put into question that assumption, and we still have it on the table. For instance, recently, Jack Ma disappeared for a period of time, the CEO of Alibaba, other major CEOs in Hong Kong also for political reason were jailed or arrested for a period of time. Some are still in jail. And from this example, we say, okay, so this will necessarily affect Chinese economic development, because you cannot have continuous economic development with this type of political system. But in practice, the situation is much more nuanced and complicated. So we had this assumption who led to another one, to the collapse, the hypothesis of the collapse of the Communist Party of China. One was related to this link between economic development and democracy. Another one is just related to our misperception or lack of understanding of the framing of the structure of China's political system.
Let's talk about these assumptions, because I think we have quite a good understanding now of where we were wrong, probably almost on everything. Why? I mean, you mentioned that, like, why did we, assumption is one, and foresight is one of the key issues. Where did these assumptions come from, and why did we not check them?
Well, the main reason is wishful thinking. We would hope, I say we, I don't necessarily include myself as an analyst, but many, I would say, president, prime ministers, they may mention Bill Clinton, I mean, including head of state in Europe, hope that China would democratize. And actually, that was a hope that motivated the conclusion, I mean, the reestablishment of diplomatic relations with the PRC in the 70s, in the 80s, with many countries. Because of this strong hope that China would democratize and would be also an easier partner to deal with, we tended to project this hope as it was a reality that was unfolding. But the reality is very different. And actually, we could decline and we could see this wishful thinking bias through different examples. For example, in innovation, we mentioned our underestimation of China's innovation capabilities, because I guess often in Washington, especially in think tank, it was very common. I don't point at a specific capital, but it was very common to underestimate China's tech capabilities, because there was a hope that the US would maintain its tech superiority in certain sectors, including telecommunication, but also some other AI, etc. So this is a hope. For example, another example, we hope that China and Russia would just be pragmatic partners. You know, we mentioned the marriage of convenience in 2014 under the context of the Crimean crisis. So there was really this hope that it would be a temporary rapprochement, and that step by step, this kind of partnership, economic partnership, would just be economic and an energy partnership that would not materialize in something stronger international organization, but in reality it's quite different.
Now you're already at the ones that I'd like to come back to at the end, at the examples of where you think we're going wrong now. But so we have wishful thinking for past biases. I think that's a very common one. What happens from a cognitive point of view is that when you have a certain idea in mind that you want to get to is that you pick only the information available that confirms that hope. Would you also say there were other things at play, such as uniqueness? The uniqueness of China's economic trajectory meant perhaps that we had no parallels in history that we could learn from?
Yeah, certainly China is a strange animal, right? The first time, maybe, because the example, I mean, closest example we could get was the USSR, which collapsed in a very different economic stage that China is today. And China is taking USSR as a counterexample for its governance system. I mean, for reinforce the control of the party, etc. But also there is an ideological framework that is pretty similar. And there is also a legacy of a Soviet bureaucracy that is still waiting in China. So more than the economic system, I think it's a very specific features of China's political system. That is, it's so different from what we know in the US, in Europe, that it's hard sometimes to analyze. And it's even more difficult to analyze that it's very opaque. It's very, very opaque. To give you an example, there was even under Hu Jintao a lot of different analysis about the potential, you know, divergences within the top leadership, you know, between clique or clans. There was a Yu Sli clan and the Red Prince or son of revolutionary cadre clan, etc. But this kind of framework of analysis is very hard to double check because you don't have access. I mean, it's not a transparent system at all politically. So we managed to see that that Xi Jinping is leading several small leadership group, as we say. So, for example, we have some view on the decision-making process. But I won't go too much into Pekinology because it's very bureaucratic. But to tell you, Florent, it's a very opaque system. It's very hard to know exactly how decisions are taken. We have more evidence now that the collective leadership framework that Deng Xiaoping tried to promote is almost gone under Xi Jinping. But this was very hard to anticipate because in addition to the opacity of the political system and the specific features of this political system, which is very framed under the supervision of the Communist Party of China, which is everywhere, once again, before I go to the another idea that jumped into my mind, but I want to say also that we underestimated the presence of the CPC everywhere. And COVID crisis reminded us that the party is present in hospital, in university, in a residential compound, is present in school, is present everywhere. It's more than 4.5 million party cells at local level. And the party itself is more than 92 million members with an increase in terms of recruitment of more than 2 million per year. So just to give you an idea, it's a very strong organization. Of course, you have different motivations for joining. Some are just pragmatic for the advantages it can provide. Some are more ideological, but it's a powerful institution and this we underestimated it. But more than the opacity, more than the weight of the party and its structure, we underestimated Xi Jinping's personality, ambition, and drive to be actually to reinforce the party's control. And also is, I would say, to reinforce the form of personality cult that we are witnessing today. When Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, there was very diverging analysis about what would be the main orientation of his mandate. Some were saying, okay, it will be food continuity with Hu Jintao. Some even said it might lead the country towards more democratization. I mean, I don't want to point and to blame at some analysts because at the time it was very difficult to anticipate the development. Why? Because in the party, you climb the ladder, you gain position by playing low profile because you have no election in China. So you have to be nominated by your predecessor and you have to kind of have to form a consensus around you. Around this nomination, around the different clan or clique that makes this within the party. So Xi Jinping played that card very cleverly, and he's a very clever person and to reach the top. And once at the top, he came out of the low profile mask and he revealed his real personality, which is a very, very strong man. And that was very hard to anticipate because you don't have much information about him.
We should never blame anybody for having not seen what's happening because these are mistakes that everybody makes. I think the point here isn't to point fingers and say, oh, you got all of this wrong, but to understand why so that we get better in the future. And then, you know, we will come back to what we're doing wrong at the moment. So you said wishful thinking. That's a very powerful one. Then there's
opacity,
which I think there's a double element here because A, it's already not easy to penetrate Chinese networks. I mean, you have gone through the effort and you've been to China and you tried to understand, but I would say that we don't have enough analysts like you, people who actually have dedicated time and interest, because I feel like in foreign policy expertise, there's always these waves. And then you're always short of those that you actually need the most pressingly, right? So when the Cold War ended, Sovietologists disappeared into all different fields. And then when Russia became a problem again, knowledge on Russia was actually very dispersed and we didn't have the knowledge. So maybe that also plays a role. But I think the last element that I think is also not to underestimate is the fact that there are elements about China and about its head of state that are completely new. And it's hard because you can't learn from history.
Yeah, and it's even contradictory because even in a highly structured, organized, non-democratic system, you have surprise. And personality matters, personality of leaders. So because, you know, that was even more surprising for analysts, because in China, you have a sense of continuity from one leader to another and deference or respect for your predecessor. For instance, Deng Xiaoping did not put into question Mao's legacy. While he said Mao, it's 70% good and 30% bad, but every human make mistake because the bad was a Cultural Revolution, but basically he was still a great leader and we still have a status of Mao in universities in China. And then came Jiang Zemin, who respecting Deng Xiaoping's legacy, and then Hu Jintao, who respected the legacy of his predecessor, and then Xi Jinping, who is still respecting the legacies of his predecessors, but at the same time, he has a much stronger personality than Hu Jintao. And it's very hard to imagine that he could contain such personality for so many years and then reveal himself as a totally different character that we analyzed. And it was a surprising thing, and that's why we should not blame anyone, is that not only many analysts outside China were surprised by his personality and the orientation taken by Xi Jinping, but also inside China, there was a lot of surprise. For example, when he launched the major anti-corruption campaign, you know, at the beginning, we thought, okay, any newly appointed party secretary has launched that campaign. You know, Deng Xiaoping has launched many, actually. Hu Jintao has launched a 2-year-long campaign, anti-corruption campaign at the beginning of his mandate from 2002 to 2004. But Xi Jinping launched it, so we thought, okay, it's normal, but it's still ongoing 8 years after now. And there is no sign that it will stop. And it's not just a normal anti-corruption campaign. It's, I would say, ideological recadrage and political process that is extremely tough and that has installed a form of fear among party elite. And I'm not saying this as judgmental. As a matter of fact, you see a lot of party cadres who seem very fearful about what they say, what they do. And you even see a form of, I would say, sometimes lack of initiative in this context. You know, party cadres, they have to repeat the keywords and the sentences of Xi Jinping. They have to learn them by heart. They have to test their knowledge about Xi Jinping thoughts on a special dedicated app on their smartphone. They have to attend training program to learn Xi Jinping thoughts, which he considers himself as in charge of revival of Marxism, right? Who should be learning even in countryside. So you have special training program for party elite. You have also a special session of criticism and self-criticism among comrades, party comrades. So it's a very specific type of control that is ongoing and that a lot of party cadres had underestimated.
I have a question about what do you think would we have done differently? Of course, we couldn't predict a personality like this, but let's assume that in the 90s and the early 2000s, we had not expected China or hoped China to become a democracy, playing by the rules of the international game as we like it, etc. What would we have done differently if we had expected what actually happened?
It's a very interesting question, and there's very different ways to answer it. But I would say maybe the doors of international organization would not have been opened so widely. For example, we could even put into question China's accession to the WTO in 2001, for instance. In general terms, I think engagement with China would not have been of the same nature. It would have been a more principled engagement. So basically, what are the results of this engagement in terms of concrete economic or openness or democratic outcome or freedom of expression, principal engagement regarding also access to the country's foreign professionals. Earlier we mentioned opacity, but the fact is that you were throwing flowers at me, we should have more analysts like you, etc. But actually, I mean, the same basket, access to the fieldwork today is rather hard, not just for researchers, but for journalists. I mean, we do. And there is more and more actually researchers and journalists working on China. So at the same time, it's a harder country to analyze, but it's a more widely covered country in terms of press coverage and research analysis. But I think we will never be enough because this opacity is reinforcing. So to go back to your question, yeah, in terms of reciprocity, you know, access to the country, not just to the market, because now the big question of reciprocity is on the table. For example, when there was a discussion, the negotiation about CAI, Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, when in principle signed just at the end of the year 2020. But this reciprocity, I think expectation would have been made much earlier if we had anticipated that China would not have opened, would not have democratized, etc. So no, it's not an easy question, but really I think a lot of things would have changed. Because again, there was this assumption that the more we engage with China, the more we, I would say democratic countries, would be able to channel it toward the direction that we would hope for. And this assumption was not really put into question. Even when China became more confident and the turning point, according to me, in terms also of wake-up call, in terms of analysis, it was well before the arrival of Xi Jinping, was the international financial and economic crisis in 2008-2009, which consolidated China's rank as second largest economy in the world and also consolidated China's confidence in its political system and economic system, especially its you know, its centralized, supervised economic system. And the confidence is now a key word. Confidence is now a key word that's promoted by Xi Jinping, especially self-confidence. So basically, China should be self-confident in four things, according to official communication. Its theories, including Marxist theories, its path of development, its culture, and its political system, most importantly. So these four things are keywords that are now repeated among the party elite, saying, well, China should be self-confident and we have enough reason to be. Look at our resistance to the 2008 and 2009 economic crisis. Look at how also we managed COVID in comparison with other countries. Of course, this could be nuanced, but the official rhetoric is this one in comparative term. And in that situation, not only China should be self-confident, but do not hesitate to provide or give lesson to countries who before were giving us lessons. So this kind of revenge approach, you know, kind of emotional tit-for-tat reaction today that should not underestimate, because I think it's just the beginning of a new wave of ideological competition.
So would you say 2009 was the wake-up call, or was that when our expectations of the 90s and early 2000s were shattered? Or when was the tipping point?
For me, as an analyst, I think the 1 or 2 years after the arrival of Xi Jinping, so around 2014, and I realized, okay, now we should stop having this view. But yeah, I really think in general term, and I don't want to put myself as an example, but the arrival of Xi Jinping make us understood that the countries were not heading what direction that many analysts and political leaders would have hoped for. But now clearly we have enough evidence now we have no doubt anymore.
So we have no doubt, but perhaps we're still under certain illusions, which brings me to the point that you mentioned earlier about China and Russia's relationship, which you think is a very important one, in which many analysts, you know, Western-based analysts, perhaps have a tendency to underestimate. What other things do you think we are, well, getting wrong? Where are our assumptions of what you see?
I think a very important point is I think we still consider that we underestimate China's ability to establish partnerships. We consider that China is isolated, and even more so with COVID-19, that the Wolf Warrior is counterproductive. There is a reaction to that, and it's true. For instance, the battle of narratives mentioned by HRVP Borrell regarding the mass diplomacy and China's assistance at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's true that China's communication strategy around COVID has generated strong reaction and was a wake-up call in many respects. But this in some countries, in some EU member states, at EU level, in the US, in Australia, in Canada, so in a significant number of countries, and the list is long, but in some other countries, China is not promoting a wolf warrior diplomacy. China has a very different type of communication strategy that is much more seductive, what is much, much softer. So at the same time, an increasing large number of countries are upset or kind of annoyed by China's communication strategy, China's positioning in international organization, China's domestic political orientation. Another group of countries are still very much supportive of China's position in international organization. To give you an example, being on Hong Kong or on Xinjiang, China, when a group of around 20, depending on the voting date, but around 20 countries are voicing their concern about Hong Kong or Xinjiang, China managed to gather around 50 countries to fight back and to support its own position on Hong Kong and Xinjiang. We might say that these are smaller countries in terms of economic power or diplomatic influence, but still, there is this gathering power that China has managed to establish, and it's still very strong. And at the core, once again, of this, what's a circle of friends that China is promoting is the Russia-China bilateral relation, which is stronger than we think. If we look at from a military perspective, economic perspective, but also technological cooperation perspective, normative perspective with joint action within international organizations. So my point here is that I consider that we tend to underestimate, or we tend to consider too quickly that China is isolated today in international, or we consider that, okay, basically in time of hardship, China cannot count on many countries, you know, and China is facing hardship today, including economic and technological sanction, very, very tough on the side of that started from Washington under the Trump administration, and that are prolonged and continued today under the Biden administration. And China has been paying the cost of this sanction. Several of these companies had to readjust their regional and international strategy. But at the same time, while China is facing more and more limited market access in the US, in Australia, in Canada, in part of Europe, it is promoting, it is pushing for more market access in sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, part of Southeast Asia, in a rather successful manner. And China's tech diplomacy of sending drones for free at the time of COVID, so the drones, but also video conference system powered by Huawei, but also thermal cameras provided by Dahua or Hikvision, which are major Chinese AI camera. This gift and sale are increasing and received in a rather positive way by countries such as Kenya, Lebanon, Cambodia. You see, so you have this kind of dichotomy between countries who are, I would say, who are toughening their position toward China and other countries who are still widely opening their doors, and even more so widely than before.
So would you say we're still in a way in the 90s in that there is still a tendency to underestimate what China is capable of?
Surprisingly, I still don't know why. that's why I should think about for the conclusion of our discussion. But we still tend to underestimate China's abilities in general terms. To innovate, to integrate international system, to promote an ambitious and efficient diplomacy, because China has developed so quickly. Maybe for this reason, we still have trouble to adjust our analysis, saying, okay, China now is a great power. It has the ability, even with the political constraint that we know, taking them into account, China is able, is an able country in many respects, with the limits we know. And again, I think the wishful thinking is altering sometimes our analysis, because it's not just a wishful thinking here, it's the inability to perceive China differently from the mainstream debate that is emerging in Europe, for instance, or that is consolidated in the US. China is increasingly seen as a threat. So we consider that most countries in the world are also perceiving that threat, but that's not a reality. There is really a strong divergence of perception among countries. And that's why I think it's interesting to exchange and analyze China, not just within Europe, but with analysts from very diverse sets of countries across the world.
Well, thank you, Alice. I want to end on a quote from the Journal of Asian Studies. I think perhaps that was the official endpoint, at least for those assumptions that were held at the time, entitled "The Populist Dream of Chinese Democracy." It dates to 2015, and it says, "Today, the China field has largely retreated from predictions of imminent democratization in favor of resignation to authoritarian endurance. Even the rare China scholar who prophesies the impending collapse of the communist system does not paint a rosy democratic future," which actually reminds me a little bit of the Arab world. When you have continuity for a really long time, you expect continuity forever. So who knows, surprise will definitely remain in store for us.
And there is always a human dimension in the equation, so we don't know.
Yes, the human factor is the most surprising factor of all. Thanks for joining me today, Alice. Thanks to you for listening to us, and join us again next time for another podcast.